listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
Welcome back to the Socialist Shelf with another interview episode. It is me, Jacob, here with Lenore. How are you doing?
Hello.
And today we have a special guest. We have Vincent Bevins. He's the author of The Jakarta Method and If We Burn, as well as a journalist. Vincent, thank you for coming on the show.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and where are you calling in from right now? Where are you at? Because I know you travel all over.
I am in London right now. I will be going up to Sheffield's tomorrow and then Glasgow on the weekend.
Oh, fun.
I'm continuing to promote this book as long as anybody will have me. So, yeah, I'm running around the UK at least for the next couple of days.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Yeah, you've been all around. I was going to ask, you know, you're being in the UK right now. I've seen that there have been some like big right now with the Palestine protests going on. Yeah. There's been some big protests in the UK. Is that still ongoing there? Or is that because it certainly is in the United States?
Oh, yeah. Still happening every Saturday. Not too far from where I am. I've been to a few of them, not every single one. But absolutely. Some of them really, really quite large.
I remember seeing there was one that was huge in London.
Yeah, I was at that one. And yeah, just right over here. And so, yeah, that continues basically every Saturday. You get, you know, sort of familiar dynamics. Members of this conservative government trying to write off the entire thing as sort of anti-Semitic or like a pro-Hamas thing. And mm-hmm. then you go there and reality is totally different. It's just like a lot of families and kids and sort of like center left people you know from around town. And yeah, this has been ongoing. Since the end of, you know, since October, really.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You know, United Kingdom, one of the countries that pulled its funding from UNRWA, you know, it's right up there with the United States in terms of complicity, you know? So yeah, it's the belly of a beast, certainly.
But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But, anyway, that was out of personal curiosity, but, you know, from asking from over there, but yeah, we're having you on today. You know, last year, If We Burn came out, and I've actually mentioned it on the podcast before. It's a book both me and Lenore have really enjoyed. But Vincent, if you want to give like kind of, I don't know, you could say the elevator pitch, but if it's a long elevator going up for a little while, that's okay. How do you usually pitch If We Burn? How do you tell people about it? Because, you know, I want to hear it in your words.
The really short elevator pitch or explanation is that it is a global history of the 2010s, that's the really short version. But again, if the elevator is going up like a bigger building, I might have time to say that it is a global history built around one specific phenomenon and one puzzling question, because you can't, you know, any history is really impossible to be comprehensive. You're always going to exclude and include certain things based on the concerns of the present. You know, all history is told and retold in the present. And this work of global history of the world, this global history from 2010 tells the story of the world from 2010 to 2020, as if the most important thing to happen in that decade is mass protest, that they got so big that they became something else, either overthrowing or fundamentally destabilizing existing governments. And the puzzling question that motivates, that organizes the story that is told is how is it that so many of these protests led to the opposite of what they apparently asked for? So that's the medium length explanation. I view it primarily as a work of history that I built through interviews in 12 countries over 4 years, but with those concerns organizing the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were, I mean, I know you spent a lot of time in Brazil and a lot mm-hmm. of the book focuses there, but I think, yeah, you said it's 12 countries overall, right?
I did research in 12 countries. The book recounts 13 cases.
13.
And 10 of those cases, I think, really qualify for what I just outlined as the criterion for like real analysis in the book. Protests that got so big, they either overthrew or fundamentally destabilized existing governments. But yeah, I mean,
it was all over the place.
Yeah, really everyone. I mean, all the episodes are outside of the traditional first world. So nothing in, none of the cases that I really look at carefully are in Western Europe or North America, but Western European and North American history and political movements become a part of the story as well.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, and in particular the nature of those movements as well, because so many of them are, as we get into, more horizontal, right? More leaderless,
Yes.
you know. So, and that's the conceit of things, how they evolved that way, and what they did well, and what they were limited in doing because of that format. It was an interesting coincidence, actually, because you start off early in the book, you describe the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, right, as an early manifestation of that sort of thing, which,
Right.
again, happy coincidence, because Jonathan Meldrod, also a friend of the show, was in that movement. So it was a case from the United Kingdom that really sort of crystallized an early an early that really kicked off an early emphasis on visible mass protests as well that you
Right.
touch on. But yeah, you very quickly hop to elsewhere in the world: Chile, Ukraine, Brazil, which you personally reported from many years for the LA Times.
Right.
So it's a really interesting trajectory to watch evolve.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, as I say, I take a approach which is historical. So not only do I try to tell just to sort of in a chronological way, rather than coming forward and saying, this is my analysis and this is my structure, this is the way that I'm going to structure the like what happened. I just decide to tell the story in order. So in that sense, my approach is historical. But also, I really think it's important to historicize protest itself, right? To
Yes.
take every single thing that was done in the 2010s, and often really felt natural, as if it were the only way, or the real way to respond to political injustice or to elite abuse, and to say, this, just like anything else, arises from particular historical circumstances. This
Certainly.
is where it came from, which is not to say that it's, that's not a value judgment, because everything is emerges historically. But I thought it was important to point to the moments that protest kind of emerges as something that human beings do, because it's not that long ago, and it is tied up always with the question of media representation and the question of what message you're sending and to whom. And so yeah, so I try to historicize as well as constructing a work of history.
Definitely.
Yeah, because prior to mass media, if you're out in like a village somewhere and you're holding up a sign and no one can take a picture, what are you trying to accomplish? Yeah, exactly. That makes sense.
Well, yeah, and I mean, as just you just indicated, like in the United Kingdom, there were people that kind of did that. They went out to nuclear installations in the middle of nowhere, and they just kind of found themselves standing in a field. And the villagers made fun of them, and the employees at the military facility just ignored them. And they discovered, kind of on accident, this was sort of like this, like the process emerges dialectically, sort of through interaction with media, and there's like a learning by doing. They realize over the course of the 50s and early the 60s, like, oh, a lot of people in the center of the biggest city in the country, that's going to be the most effective, because that's where the media are, and they're going to reproduce the images, which are far more powerful than any like single conversation that I'm going to have with a single security guard, which was really kind of the idea behind the original incarnation of Gandhian tactics in the UK. Is like, well, we're going to convert people directly, and then there is, oh no, like you can like get a message to like 100 million people at once if you're in the right place at the right time. So yeah, this emerges only because of its interaction with mass media. I think this is fundamental to understanding what happens in the 2010s as well.
Yeah, I remember there was one time. Lenore, were you there when we went down to Folkestone here in Georgia?
No, that was the I went to one closer to here, but not to
Okay.
Folkestone specifically.
There was a time where some folks we organized with the PSL here in the United
Okay.
States went down to Folkestone, Georgia, where they're have an ICE detention facility in a very small town. In fact, the ICE detention facility is like once they're finished with it, is going to be almost as many beds as there are people in the town, which is
Oh,
crazy.
wow.
But even organizing a protest, there's a lot of questions of like, hey, we're bringing people in and we've got people in the community, but we've got to make sure, we've got some good video and we've got whatever, and we've got,
Right.
and it ended up working out that actually a lot of the folks in the prison and the detention facility were outside in the yard. So we were interacting with them, and actually it ended up being very powerful, but it's only because you were able to actually get the message out to people that it is effective. But I will also say that a big part of this book is a million people in the streets with a million different slogans can
Right,
also
right.
lead to some interesting stuff. I think maybe it made me laugh, but there's a part in, about it in Brazil, and I mean it's funny, but it's also very serious. It's somebody just in like a V for Vendetta mask delivering
Yes.
commands for the crowd. Could you like
Right.
tell about that? Because that's one of my favorite anecdotes from the story.
Yeah, and so yeah, the dynamic that you mentioned is really interesting, and like with your experiences, right? Because like I don't know if we're more or less the same age, but everyone in our generation kind of grew up with this like already internalized that if you're going to do a protest, you have to like plan to generate content.
Right.
But that like really wasn't natural. Like that had to be learned back in the 50s and 60s. These people were like, oh my God, like you can really reach a lot of people with the media. Whereas like probably to a problematic extent, I and everybody else I know are like always already trying to think about how whatever we do is going to be consumed on social media. So yeah,
Yeah.
like this emerges historically, and you can argue whether it's good or bad. But yeah, this case in Brazil is really interesting because I ended up tracking down the actual person, and this was I went back to Brazil initially in 2019, but sorry, 2021, but I've been there on and off for since 2010. To work on this book, and my story where I kind of like unmasked the V for Vendetta guy is one that the Workers' Party, like members of Lula's own government, like told me to look up when they were like trying to tell me like how fucked up the 2013 June protests had become. And I was like, oh well, I wrote that story. I was actually the guy that tracked him down, and so I'm very aware. What happens in June 2013? And this is a story that you can like talk about for a long time if you're on a very, very long elevator, but I'll try to do it quickly. You have a group of leftists and anarchists that have been organizing against public transportation fees in general since 2005. And in June 2013, for various reasons, this gets quite a lot of attention, but the attention it gets is negative, and the media decides that the police need to crack down. The media call for a police crackdown. And the military police in Brazil is a legacy of the US-backed dictatorship. Like they never demilitar they demilitarized politics, but never demilitarized police.
Sure.
And so if Brazilian media had been part of the class of Brazilian society that usually experienced military police repression, they should have known how bad this was going to go, but they called for the repression. And then they were shocked by the crackdown that they called for. And what this did, or what this effected among sort of Brazil's mainstream oligarch-owned dominant media was that they flipped their narrative from saying we need to get these punks and anarchists off the streets to this is a good thing. This is a uprising in defense of the right to rise up, and this is about the freedom of expression, and it's about everything that people want it to be about. And so I watched on the street as this strange transformation occurs where 4 days later, a lot of people come that have nothing to do ideologically with the sort of like the original organizers who often came from like the anarcho-punk scene. Like almost all of them were from the anarcho-punk scene, and they were all quite like they had like read quite a lot of like leftist. They were like anarcho-punks that like read theory and like fought like organized very, very conscientiously around the idea of creating a popular revolt, but they kind of never thought that they would actually cause one, or at least they hadn't prepared for what would happen if millions of people come to the streets. So what you have concretely 5, 6 days later is millions of people with maybe millions, maybe more ideas of what this is really about. And there's kind of a fight as to what it's about. And they keep insisting, well, no, this is about the original demand. This is about a 20-cent rise in the bus fare. And but a lot of other people say, no, it's not. And so there's this fight happening in the streets and on social media and on television as to what is this uprising really about. And then you get a video which drops. And at the time, like, I remember this, but it seems so distant now that it's hard to like to understand that it was actually real. But back then, anything that was like internet-y was necessarily positive and progressive. And so Anonymous, this group, which is like because they're from the internet, they're doing hacktivism,
Yeah, I
had just
remember.
like a lot of people just sort of had a lot of natural sympathy for whatever that was, Anonymous. And so this video drops on YouTube, and it appears to be Anonymous. It's a man in a mask, he's wearing the V for Vendetta mask, and he says, well, no, this is what it's really about. We need to unite behind causes that the whole country can agree upon, and we'll leave politics aside. which is kind of strange because, like, well, you know,
It's
what kind of
inherently
a de-
political, right?
yeah,
Yeah, exactly.
what kind of a demand are you going to make in a protest that's not political? And then he immediately drops five, I would argue, kind of conservative and very formalistic demands. None of them were about material conditions for working Brazilians. They're all about sort of esoteric legislation, legislative concerns, which really came out of like would have been familiar to people that were reading conservative media in Brazil at the time. But like this video, for whatever reason, and you know, in the last 10 years, like marketing ad, you know, agencies and like the CIA have probably spent billions of dollars trying to figure out what does go viral. But back, you know, for whatever reason, it goes viral. And a few days later, you see people on the streets with signs saying five demands, the five demands. I'm here for the five demands. And I track this guy down 6 months later. And I say, oh, well, that's really, you know, thank you. Can you prove to me that you made this video? He like does the thing where he like changes the YouTube profile in such a way that I can recognize. Okay. I said, oh, this is really interesting. How did Anonymous come up with the demands? And he's like, what do you mean anonymous? The whole point of Anonymous is it is whatever I say it is. I just got a mask and made this video. I copied the editing. I just like copied the genre. I just like put the distortion effects, and I got these demands from stuff that I saw on Facebook. And I was like, okay, well, you tricked quite a lot of people because they kind of thought Anonymous was a real thing. But this is symptomatic of the mass protest decade in general, right? Is like you have organizations that appear to be organizations, but they're really not. Like as soon as you look closer, it is just kind of who went viral. And this is something that happened, I think, in quite a lot of countries from 2010 to now.
Exactly. It really sort of teases out the another big theme in this work, which is that there's no such thing as a political vacuum, right? You know, a retreat from politics is, you know, I mean, it's kneecapping yourself because there are always going to be organized political forces that will impose meaning from without if you don't go into it with that sort of meaning. And it's interesting to see this guy taking off. Not even as part of a cohesive organization, but just by virtue of the novelty, right? Just by virtue of going viral, you know, suddenly his stuff catches on.
And it's arguably nonsense, right? I mean, it was packaged well because it was like, oh, we're bringing everyone together. Like, and this is really a fundamentally an anti-political and perhaps even an anti-democratic sentiment to be like, I'm not doing politics right now. Politics is bad. Politics is those guys. What I'm doing is not politics. But it's packaged well. It kind of gets your blood going. Like, I actually had included this at the beginning of as like an epigram. Is it an epigraph? Sorry, epigraph. And one of the early versions of the book, you know, like that, like sample in the Kanye West song, where it's like nobody knows what it means, but it gets the people going. Yeah, that's kind of was what was at work here in this YouTube video, and this is at like at work, I think, in a lot of the mass protest decade. It's like, okay, there's five things. Yeah, this is like a cool look. I mean, some people must have thought it was cool at the time. Cool looking mask, a cool looking presentation. This seems to be what the thing is about. But again, like if you wanted to at the time, you could go to the Facebook group of the MPL, the original punks and anarchists that are putting together the demonstrations, and you could read their sort of like quite theoretically sophisticated explanations for what they were doing. But if you were just coming to this now, it was just as easy to think, well, no, that's really who's doing this. It's one of these anonymous things. And it just like works. And yeah, so in the book, a fundamental dynamic is that of the power vacuum. But you also have narrative vacuums. You have moments where people need to understand what's happening, and then when a movement cannot speak for itself, someone else speaks for it.
It's also interesting to me that, like, if you think about it from the organizing perspective, you want to have, if you're an organizer or someone in these spaces, you want to have a somewhat theoretically advanced view of things. You want to be educated, but you also want to be able to deliver demands effectively, strong slogans for the reason you laid out, because somebody is going to do it. And I find that to be an interesting, interesting from like the perspective of, if you want to be someone that's out there leading protests or involved or union organizing or any type of organizing, It's important to kind of marry those things and figure out, well, what
Right.
are some slogans that will speak to people that aren't just based on something I saw on YouTube, you know?
Yeah,
And this book inspired me to think about that.
and it's funny that you, because like I totally agree. And these kind of lessons emerged, I think, in the mass protest decade. But both things that you said would have been like obvious and natural for the vast majority of the revolutionary movements in the 20th century. Like even the codified, like even the most rigid and codified version of Leninist revolutionary practice always insisted on both things. So one, there isn't a revolutionary movement without a revolutionary theory. Like if you don't have an actual idea of what you're doing and and it's not quite advanced and based on actual knowledge, then you're just going to reproduce the given society that you're already in. But also you must always be in contact with the people. Like you can't just go over it on your own and come up with some great theory and tell yourself that you're the vanguard. You're not the vanguard if no one's following you. You must have your own correct analysis, but you also must be very, very aware of what the people in the country believe, and you must know that they're actually on your side. Because if they're not actually on your side, then what you're doing is adventurism, if not like, or if not worse, right? You're being authoritarian and you're imposing your will on people that don't agree with you. So all of that would have been really, really natural in the 20th century. But somehow in the 2010s, I don't know, through various factors, material and ideological, we ended up thinking that the internet sort of changed everything, or thinking that things were a lot easier, or there were certain elements that were so resolute in rejecting everything that had anything to do with the Soviet Union that they wanted to do things entirely differently. But yeah, both things you say, I think, are pretty clearly, even if you're not like left, right, or center, they're pretty clear. If you're trying to change society, you have to really know what you're doing, and you have to have people on your side.
It's interesting. We
Absolutely.
did an episode on V for Vendetta, and speaking about the Alan Moore graphic novel more than anything.
Right.
And one thing that we were like kind of, it's a fun story, but one thing we were laughing about during it is it's like this kind of for this to work in this world, you have to have this all-powerful guy who can pull things
Right.
off and be in touch with the people.
Right.
And in the graphic novel, he has the computer that controls the whole country too. I think in the movie, he's just more of like a super soldier. But it kind of, I mean, the V for Vendetta mask kind of makes me think of that. And then the whole anonymous movement in general, I think, is kind of emblematic of that, of this idea of like, well, maybe there are some people on the internet who are hacked into the code and they're going to control
Right.
everything and
Right.
we're in link. And it's like, no, there's actually just not these super soldiers out there. And we did this in, I say we, like the mass culture did this in 2020 as well. I remember in the American protest in 2020, there were people like, oh, well, there's these, you would hear it from the right, but you would hear it from the left, like, oh, there's these super groups of underground Antifa cells that are gonna, and it's like, no, actually, there's not so much.
No, there's not. Well, this was something. This is really. This reminds me. He's in the book. You might remember him, but Piero Locatelli, the guy who was arrested for carrying vinegar and then ended up generating this kind of cringe name for the protest, the V for Vinegar uprising of 2013. Later in 2013, you get the appearance of Black Bloc tactics in much, much smaller protests that really are no longer supported by that many people. But he's the one that keeps going in the media and saying, look, Black Bloc is not like a unit. It's a thing you do. Like he's like repeatedly saying, like, look, there's no there you can't discover the Black Blocs. They're not going to be like in some base somewhere. Black Bloc is like a perform, like not, or like an activity. Like you put on a particular set of clothing and you do things for 3 hours. You are a Black Bloc for an afternoon. It's not like you have a base, which was like this was something that he had to keep hammering on throughout the 2013. And then yeah, like so V for Vendetta, the grass. So I rewatched the movie for V for Vendetta for while I was writing this book because. Precisely because everybody says the graphic novel is more sophisticated, I wanted to get like the really, really dumbed down version that a lot of people had actually consumed in the 2010s. And in the movie, it's really interesting because like the theory of, so it's like it is like infantile, right? Like so on the one hand, the revolutionary organizing is hyper, hyper, hyper Leninist. Like you have like a vanguard party of one.
One guy and his
Yeah.
secretary.
It's literally a single guy that's making viral TikTok videos that he, but he can like hack the computer and just like all he does is he makes really, really convincing videos and puts them on screens throughout the country, right? So on the one hand, it's like ultra-Leninist to the point where it's not actually just a single brilliant tactician and that's it. And then ultra-spontaneist in the sense that, okay, at the moment, all that is required is to get all of the guys. I mean, I guess women, there's probably women too, but they all looks like guys when in the final scene. The final scene is just like a million guys in masks, like marching on Parliament, right?
And they've
And
done the
like,
thing, yeah.
those of us that have lived through January 6th or January 8th or whatever, January 8th is Brazilian edition. It's like, well, what is that supposed to like? What? Okay, maybe they run away, but like, who are these guys, and what kind of a society are they going to build? And there's just the really deep belief in if the people, quote unquote, the people come to the streets, well, then that's problem solved, you know? And that was, I think deep down what a lot of people thought in the 2010s. I probably believed it deep down in some. I wouldn't have defended that thesis intellectually if someone put it to me, if someone put it to me in those words. But I kind of did believe it deep down. Like when millions of people took the bridge in São Paulo and like the people were rising up behind this progressive set of demands, I just kind of thought that would take care of itself. And well, it really didn't. And I think in the case of the movie V for Vendetta, you'd have to ask, like, well, if this is actually a fascist British state, they have two choices here. They just kill those guys, which is
With
not
their
hard to
firepower,
do.
which is objectively superior.
Yeah, exactly. Like if they wouldn't be a fascist prison state if they didn't have the ability just to shoot down 10,000 guys in the center of the city. Or if they do run away, well, like what's going to happen now? Like it's very difficult to take over a complex modern state, and who's going to do it, and according to what ideology, and how do you know that they're not going to be, So anyways, V for
Especially
Vendetta.
considering, spoiler alert, the V character dies. It's like, oh, it's over. We don't have any
Yeah,
plan now. V was everything.
you've lost your one man vanguard with the perfect knowledge that one man needs to be a vanguard of his own, merits,
Exactly. So, yeah, there was reasons that V for Vendetta the movie is not a great inspiration. Yeah, and of course, like every movie, he can like beat up 900 people at once, which is, I think that's just like every Hollywood movie has that now. Everyone's Batman, but he's also Batman.
Hugo Weaving has a hell of a voice, though. I got to give him that.
Oh no, it's great,
Well,
yeah.
to tie into the sort of mass media aspect of things, the title, could you talk about the title itself, If We Burn? Because I found it to be very emblematic of the decade, 2010 to 2020, as well, for a number of reasons, even though it actually comes from a book that we have not covered yet, that we have covered its sort of progenitor, Battle Royale.
Right. So, If We Burn, again, short elevator explanation is it's from Hunger Games. Like it's at one point in the movies, and it's again, it matters that it's the movie, not the
Yeah, it matters more,
book,
yeah.
because it's not the he it's not a the guy doesn't post a paragraph from a book. He posts a GIF from the movie. Katniss Everdeen, played by American actress Jennifer, is it Jennifer Lawrence, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence.
Says, "If we burn, you burn with us." And this is like an epic moment in the film, I suppose. But the story of how this comes to matter at all in Hong Kong in 2019 is kind of reminiscent of the story I just told about the anonymous guy back in 2013 in Brazil. So there is a Hong Konger, not living in Hong Kong, but he's active on the kind of Hong Kong version of Reddit in organizing international pressure on the state of Hong Kong. And basically he's just posting on Reddit on Hong Kong Reddit all the time. That's basically it. This guy is not one of the organized groups. Like, so in Hong Kong, regardless of your analysis of the political content of the final, like the last 4 months of the year, there is a moment in June when quite a lot of people get put on the street. And this is an organization that, yeah, sorry, so this
You're
the
good.
Hong Kong Civic Human Rights Association. I think I might have even got that wrong. But anyways, in June, are quite a lot of people that come onto the streets in protests organized by this one group. This guy is not in contact with that group or the masses. He is on the right. The second time that I met him in London, he was wearing like a pin in support of the British monarchy. This is a guy that is just posting on the Hong Kong version of Reddit. And he has a post at some point in the second half of 2019 that he just ends with a GIF. He just like he ends with a GIF from Hunger Games. And the slogan is, "If we burn, you burn with us." And again, he just kind of puts that because it like is kind of what his profile name had always been, because there's a slogan in Cantonese that it like indicates a kind of a very aggressive poker strategy, like mutually assured destruction or whatever. And all that happens is this post from a guy, you know, he ends up mattering because of this moment, just goes viral, just gets loads of upvotes on the Hong Kong version of Reddit. And then, you know, lo and behold, a few weeks later, it might be days, I can check the dates, people in the streets are carrying signs that say, "If we burn, you burn with us." And what becomes clear over the course of 2019, including to him, is this is just not right. Like, if you are in Hong Kong and really you're trying to get Beijing to do something different, Hong Kong can burn and Beijing doesn't burn at all. Like, it's just whatever you, and again, there are all kinds of disagreements as to what Hong Kong 2019 actually wanted, what was behind it, what it would have meant if it succeeded. But just as if you extrapolate the slogan from out of the Hong Kong context and just analyze, it's just not right. Like, go back. Like, if you are on fire, you don't, you being on fire does not cause your enemies to do anything, especially if you're in a different city. And they believed, some people did believe in Hong Kong that, oh, if Hong Kong kind of grinds to a halt for a few months, then Beijing cannot, the PRC cannot operate. And that they came to the conclusion, well, this was a miscalculation. We overestimated how important we were. Because, you know, in the 70s or 80s, Hong Kong was really important. You know, like Hong Kong was a huge part of, would have been a huge part, would have been a huge percentage of the PRC economy. By 2019, it's really not. And, you know, again, why does it become a slogan? I think it's really the same thing that I, you know, was referring to in 2013. Nobody knows what it means, but it gets the people going. Like, it was just like, yeah. And, the longer you think about the dynamic, it's just not correct that if you burn, then your enemies must also pay the price. And even if they do pay a symmetrical price, which is, you know, really depends on a lot of things, if they're much, much larger than you, you know, they have much more resources, then that's not a great tactic.
Yeah, I mean, it connotes a you know, individuals and small groups of people in certain ways are capable of punching above their weight, but it connotes a unity of action and a breadth of action that just did not exist at that point.
Right. And you know, and then at the in a more fundamental, and this becomes, this is important in other cases throughout the book as well. If you are, for example, in the center of Cairo, that becomes, and really shutting down the center of Cairo, that becomes very difficult for the Egyptian government to ignore because that's the capital city. Hong Kong represents a tiny population percentage of the entire PRC. And even if all, like, even if the vast majority of Hong Kong were united on a very specific demand, which is not the case, I think there was a small majority for a kind of a loose idea of more autonomy. Then that is still something that the, like, Beijing, the real decision makers are very, very far away. And so you get the reproduction of tactics throughout the mass protest decade that made a lot of sense in one place that didn't make a lot of sense in another place. And when you're not even in the capital, shutting down one city is something that can be just ignored by central authorities, and that seems to be probably what happened in the case of Hong Kong 2019. Yeah, sorry. The thing that it doesn't matter, but it bothered me that I, yeah, it was this. It's the civil human rights front. Sometimes I mix up civic human rights front, and these were the people that told me, these people that did actually have enough contact with the Hong Kong people to get a lot of people on the streets in June. They ultimately came to the conclusion. One guy admitted it to me, and then he like was like surprised that he admitted it to me, that his movement had been used by the West, that he had been betrayed by the West, that was interested more in, much more in sort of trying to hurt Beijing or humiliate the Communist Party of China than actually trying to help him. And he came to be quite bitter about the ways that his movement had interacted with the West.
I recall in 2019 when these protests were going on, trying to learn about them and having a lot of trouble figuring out what they were actually about beyond like sort of platitudes. I mean, and that's me reading, of course, English media, and I ended up getting into the weeds and finding out that there was like a number of different things and some and it, but yeah, it's exactly what happened. When you read like the New York Times article about it or whatever, it would say like anti-authoritarianism. I'm like, that's a lot of, that can mean a lot of things, you know? That's that doesn't mean anything. And I remember being very frustrated because I was like, you know, my knee-jerk reaction was to be like sympathetic with any mass movement. And not to say that there weren't like legitimate demands among that mass movement, but like you said, it was this whole kind of smorgasbord of people, everyone from these people who were worried about human rights to people who were worried about Hong Kong as an entity, towards people who were spray painting racial slurs on an embassy, like, you know, like as you said. And it's you know, and it obviously this it's beyond the scope to talk about everything that happens within these protests. But I remember at the time, even having a less sophisticated political analysis, but still being like, it doesn't seem to be anything.
Like this is something that happens all over the place. A really good way of simplifying whatever it is you're asking for, and getting positive media coverage, especially if you have a movement which is likely to get positive media coverage. And I think of there is a high, you know, there's a high degree of elective affinity between movements that target official enemies of the United States and positive media coverage. I think that's just something that's deep, ingrained deep in the mind of like Western journalists. Like if a movement is taking aim at a bad country, that, like there's going to be more space given to think about whether it's good, whether it, than, you know, a protest movement targeting Germany or something.
Sure.
Okay, so as a rule, saying that it's about democracy is an easy way to simplify whatever, and which is like every, but like it's kind of like tautological at this point, right? Because democracy means everything for everybody now, so everybody by definition will always say that they're protesting in support of democracy because everyone believes in that, in that what they're asking for is their version of democracy. In the case of Hong Kong, I think autonomy is probably a better word for the broadest motivation there. Is it was a small majority of people that wanted sort of in the one country two systems
Sure.
one country two systems model, people that valued two systems rather than one country. There was a small majority for that, probably. And that was probably why the extradition bill mattered so much. But this was an error that my people made throughout the decade is the only question we asked at our worst was, is the movement in opposition to somebody or some system that we think is bad? And then after that, there was no more questions asked. There was no questions asked as to what would replace it if this movement were to win. What are they actually asking for? What are the class and ideological demographics of this movement? Because in the case of Hong Kong, there was some people that wanted actual independence from China, but it was like that was never more than about 20% of the population of Hong Kong. So those people that were putting that as forward as the actual Talos, the ideal endpoint of the movement, were really not in touch with the masses. A lot of people told me that going to the US and trying to, you know, enlist an obvious geopolitical rival against the government in Beijing was both a moral and tactical error because people were against this, and often it opened you up to the accusation that you were collaborating with a foreign entity. You know, one Hong Konger said to me again privately, he's like, well, what if it turned out in the George Floyd uprising in 2020? And this is somebody that organized the protest, right? So this is not some kind of someone that wants to be reflexively pro-Beijing. He's like, I got to thinking, like, what if in 2020, during the George Floyd uprising in the United States, it became clear that the Communist Party of China was funding some of the groups that were organizing? He's like, the United States would react very, very poorly to this, and
Of
this is what
course. Very
happened.
violently, yes.
And this is what happened, he said, in the case of Hong Kong. But yeah, you know, we made this mistake. We oversimplified, and we like to tell a simple, easy story, especially because, you know, unfortunately, we exist in social media too. People like me, we just like the guy with the V for Vendetta mask, or the guy on Hong Kong version of Reddit, Fin Lao. We exist in a world where we know sort of deep down subconsciously that certain things are likely to get more reposts, retweets, sort of larger audiences than other things. And I think that was a failure that people made, both because they didn't know enough and also because they kind of, you know, thought, oh, you know, this narrative will be quite satisfying to people back in the United States.
I can't help but think of that. You're talking about the social media, that video of Kamala that was going around. You exist in the context of all
Of all that.
that. That's
Hey,
terrible. I'm sorry.
It's not wrong. She just
No,
kind
it's
of
not
is,
wrong. It's
she
the
just has a
delivery.
goofy
It's not the
delivery.
steak. No, I saw it. It said that that's me, after going to the bar at Waffle House trying to explain dialectical materialism to somebody.
Why am I ordering so much food right now? Well, I
Yeah.
exist in the context of everything around
I fell out of a coconut tree. I got hungry
me.
now.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly.
It's that thing of where, it's the fundamental, the amorphousness of it, right? A movement that is not necessarily trying to be everything for everybody, but everybody has essentially a, it's a flattened landscape where everybody can impart meaning to this, and it becomes very and it becomes very easy to, yeah, exactly, for even if one faction accepts, foreign aid or foreign support from the United States, from geopolitical rivals, suddenly it becomes very easy because of that flattening effect, because of that leaderlessness, to say, okay, this is fundamentally an astroturfed thing, right? Regardless of the validity thereof, which again, it points to the, it points to the necessity of, if you're going to make a political project out of this, you have to be, you have to have a, you have to have some form of authority. You have to have some form of, you have to have a political project which you're organizing toward and which you're communicating.
Yeah, and it's funny, like there's two words that you just used that I'm gratified that you like on the, flattening, I think, is something that really happened in the mass protest decade. And you got it was a lot easier to see everything in, say, Ukraine as one thing rather than a movement, like a historical process with distinct movements, distinct factions that actually evolved over time. It was a lot easier just to say it's all about this. And that was almost always wrong, this process of flattening in the mass protest decade, because things really did change and like different people were involved for different reasons. And then you said, you have to have some form of authority. In the 2010s, there was a lot of people that would be very quick to withdraw from anything that appeared to be authority whatsoever.
Right, no
But at the
stage,
same time,
everything
these are
is
all
paying.
people that would celebrate Martin Luther King,
Right.
right? These are all people, these are all, there was a kind of hyper spontaneity, right? A belief in hype, in ex an extreme reaction to leadership that ended up putting people in a strange position where they would have been calling CORE and SNCC and Martin Luther King the people that actually created the like modern repertoire of the effective protest movement. By the standards of the 2010s, they would have been called authoritarian.
Right.
And it was a, and it was, it would be great if you could put together a movement in which there was never any representation or no one ever emerged to speak for the group. But it turns out that someone does emerge that speaks for the group. And it's much better to have that person be an organic contact, actually really representing a real movement like Martin Luther King did, than just be a guy who can go viral with the most exciting gif from a general Jennifer Lawrence with flames behind her.
Yeah, it's this sort of shying away from authority, shying away from leadership. It's this, I think there's a tendency when somebody's, I don't want to say elevated in that fashion, because that implies like being above criticism, because like there's a tendency, I think, to divorce leadership from accountability when really those things are like interlinked. I mean, even a titanic figure such as King, right? There can be forces, like he was initially against the slogan Black Power, because of what it might imply about the movement, and Mukasa Dada himself said, yeah, no, we re-educated King on that front. There are certainly moments where the masses that you're guiding can push back and say, no, actually, this is more representative of where the people are at, right?
That's real readership. That's real representation. So, I'm not, there have been, this is a thing that happened in 20th century and it will happen again. You do get the case of like four guys just wandering around saying, we're the leadership, we're the vanguard of the masses, and
Oh, we see
we
it
have
all the
the,
time.
yeah,
Yeah.
we
In the streets of Atlanta, it happens nonstop.
we have the correct theory, and because we know the right things, that means we're the vanguard. Well, you're not really the vanguard if no one's following you. And
Right.
real leadership, real representation, is when the people have selected you to speak for a movement. But then when they, if you were to abuse your position, if you are you abuse your platform, if you are to do things that puts you ahead of or behind, or just you just lose your mind and you lose contact with the people that are that you represent, then they remove you. You know, and like Sean Fain, for example, who's like, you know, a classic example of like the return of like a 20th century structure. You
Sure.
know, he's the one speaking for UAW, but if he start if he can't just say whatever, because he'll lose his position immediately, right? He has to have the support of the actual workers. And this is something that was very familiar to everyone in the 20th century, but somehow, I don't know, we thought the internet changed everything, or we thought that we could sort of shortcut past the hard work of building collective power. And you know, it would have been great. It would have been great if we could just jump to victory. But yeah, it turns out that these processes really matter in moments of struggle, and a successful protest movement engenders moments of struggle, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, we had referred to him earlier, but Jonathan Melrod on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. He's in the Progressive Caucus of the United Auto Workers and all that. And he even actually kind of touched on it. He's like, you can have people that are skeptical of like union leadership and all that, and then he's like, but we elect them and there's real democracy, and if it doesn't work, then we remove them. That's how it ought to work. And so yeah, and that was interesting. Actually, by the way, you'll appreciate this. He literally said he was your book was next on his list of books to read. So
Oh, that's great. Quite a few union people have actually gotten in contact. I've gotten pretty good feedback from union people. But yeah, I
good.
think I say in the book, to bring this back to pop culture, I think there's like one
Please.
line. I don't know how I go into this, but by the middle of the 2010s, the possibilities of real representation had seemed so distant. The links between the represented and those who represent them became so frayed that when you use the word, people just thought of like someone on TV that looked like them. You know,
Right.
like representation came to just mean by the end of the 2010s, like, is my particular demographic reproduced in pop culture? Like, and
Right.
obviously that dynamic, and like that is kind of like, I think, quite a bad answer to a real question is like, well, stan culture is because I don't actually have anybody in the mainstream that I actually that represents me, that I have selected to be there, that I can control in some indirect way, I will like pick my avatar and just
Right.
sort of pretend that they're doing what I want them to do. No matter what they do, I'll pretend that it represents my true desires, because we've lost contact with the type of representation which would have been very natural in the Black Panther Party, for example. It was very
Right.
natural that you could join, become a cadre, be involved in the organization, carry out some task, maybe move up the organization, be part of a, you know, be part of a collective struggle. And well, now we kind of like watch, you know, music videos and television to pick our favorite guy and be like, that's my guy or that's my girl.
Sure.
And that's a very, very, I think, impoverished concept, impoverished conception of representation.
And that's not limited by any means to the left either. You know, I think
No, not
of
at all.
people like Donald Trump's fans basically spending all their time posting, what is it, the frog with the blonde hair, or the Pepe the Frog, and it's just a Trump version of it, and being like, anytime he does anything, it's like all part of the plan. I mean, like you have that's, and it's like not because even if it's something they disagreed with 5 minutes ago, because they've chosen this guy as their avatar of like vengeance for
Yeah, well, this is the
whatever reason.
classic shortcut which works so well for the authoritarian right. And this is like the classic playbook of fascism in general, like the
Right.
historical fascism is that, oh, instead of building, you know, let's go back to the 30s, instead of slowly building the SPD over decades and having a mass labor movement, which, you know, by 1914, you know, supports World War I. But I would say that's like the classic, at the time, that would have been the classic social democratic vision, is you build an organization that puts somebody forward that is responsible to the membership. The fascist answer is just like, let's just put a guy. We just grab a guy, and then we will mystically say that he does represent the people. And then we all
Right.
just have to get behind that. And some people really believed in it. You got lots of Germans saying, oh yeah, that guy, that's my guy. But it was backwards. It was top down. And then if you didn't agree, there was, you know, there was big problems. But that's the classic, you know, that's the fascist shortcut, which, you know, is part of, you know, why that movement is so dangerous, is because it can sort of jump a lot of the work that properly democratic movements have to do in order to have legitimacy, is to build from the bottom up, or and or have sort of interaction between the top and the bottom where they just grab a guy and he's like, yeah, that's my guy. I don't care. As long as he's crushing my enemies, he represents me and I'm with whatever he or she says.
Yes, it sells, not only that this one guy can represent you, but if that's the case, if I alone can fix it, as whoever says, whichever figure, suddenly you recuse your involvement in that political project, or if you are involved, you become essentially a foot soldier, right? You can be deployed in whatever capacity and not really have to interrogate it. It's that sort of disengagement, I think, is as much a product of fascism as active recruitment.
Yeah, I mean, it's an easy answer. And this is why, you get this in the 2010s as well. It's like, it is a type of resignation to just say, well, I'm against all politics. Because, first of all, you're not. But you can pretend that it's an easy way out and just say, well, all of that is bad stuff. I'm out. And it's a way, it's comforting at an individual level because you can maybe preserve your moral purity. You can say, I'm not involved, but really, you are involved. And it seems like a shortcut, but it's really a trap.
If there's no way not to have an opinion about how resources are to be allocated and organized, you're essentially a houseplant if you don't have such an opinion. But I mean, people still have to water houseplants.
And houseplants need to consume resources themselves. Houseplants need water and fertilizer and sunlight. And you, as a citizen of the United States or any other country, you are consuming resources that have been appropriated to you as a result of a given economic system. You're not responsible for the construction of that system, but you're not outside of it. You are inside of it.
Exactly.
It's interesting. When I was on the United Auto Workers picket line, there was a guy I'd spoken to for like 15 minutes about the union, and he's all in. He's all in on the strike, and he's all in. And he even gets into without even me prompting it, he's like, and we're sending too much money overseas on war and this. And he says, but like at the end of the day, I'm not really a political person. I was like, you're on a picket line right now. Like you're
Exactly.
sacrificing your paycheck to be here every, you know what I mean? Like he's inherently political. But I
Yeah, well,
think
this is a
sometimes for
yeah,
people, that
please
just
go on.
comes down to I don't like the structure that is. But that's not the same thing as not political, which is, I guess, a message that
Yeah,
maybe.
you're not apolitical, you're alienated.
Yeah, there you
Yeah.
go.
And this is a quite an American, I mean, I'm fully trained up member of the mainstream media, but this is a really American ideological element. That like in the mainstream media, you can tell yourself that you're quote unquote objective as long as you just like treat the two parties equally. Like you can have an incredibly strong opinion about Israel or Palestine or China or anything else, but the idea of politics as the narrow, narrow range of opinions that are fought, the very, very narrow range of issues that the two parties argue over, that's politics. Everything else is not politics. The only thing that is politics is the differences between the Democratic and Republican Party. So often people, when they say in the US, a classic guy, like your uncle at Thanksgiving or whatever, my uncle, if you're like, let's not talk about politics, that means let's not talk about the stuff that MSNBC and Fox News fight over. But that's a tiny, an incredibly narrow conception, and I think it's quite American.
Absolutely. Well, one more thing I really wanted to, touch on is I was gonna ask, now that we're not in the protest decade anymore, now that we're in the 2020s, not that there's not been protests and they're not going to continue to be protests, there are right now. Do you see any of these trends changing, or do you feel like it's staying the same? And as sort of a second part of that, kind of wrapping up here, but what lessons, I mean, they maybe already kind of inherently have come out of the conversation, but what lessons do you think people need to learn, and what do we need to be thinking about, especially now as there's a ton of protests? I mean, I was at a protest in DC not long ago that was like several hundred thousand people. I
Two of
mean,
them.
yeah, two of them. Exactly.
So I think that your second question can be answered within the answer to the first one. Sorry
Go
if I'm
for
being a little bit cute there.
it.
So the I do on the to the question of whether or not the trends are changing, I would say on the one hand, people seem to have, it's not just the interviewees in the book, my book. A lot of people have been paying attention to the way things work in an era of mass protest and mass media and social media reproduction. And I do see people learning to some extent some of the lessons that have emerged in the book and also in our conversation. So some of the stuff that we've seen in support of Palestine, for example, is very intentional about being clear and not being spontaneous. So because there is an understanding that there will be a fight to define what you're doing and who you are, sort of the JVP actions where everyone wears the same t-shirt and does a very quite a disciplined occupation of Grand Central Station. It says Jewish Voice for Peace, Ceasefire Now, Jews for Peace. That seems to have incorporated some of the things that we've talked about today. Is that it that's, you know, if everyone's wearing the same shirt, clearly this is not a spontaneous action, right? We had to like print hundreds of shirts.
Yeah, and unity of action, unity of demand.
Yeah. And so on one hand, one part of your answer is that, yeah, I have seen some people incorporating some of the quote unquote lessons that I think that we've talked about for the last hour or so. On the other hand, I do think that it remains the case that mass protest is the easiest and most readily available tactic to most people. So in the 2010s, a particular type of response to injustice became quite popular, if not hegemonic or even appearing natural. And I think that form of protest, even though it emerged historically, even though it's suited for some things and not for others, even though it has a lot of strengths but quite a lot of weaknesses, I do think that it remains the ease. Like, again, when Israel responds to October 7th with ethnic cleansing and mass murder, everyone's first thought is protest, right? It's like, it remains the case. Right. It remains the dominant form. And I think that will remain, it will remain the case. So even if you might come to the conclusion that, oh, actually the mass protest should not be privileged, we need to think about other ways of struggle. We need to think about direct pressure, economic pressure, political pressure, building power, building concrete power here and now, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that protest is not going away. I think it still remains the easiest and most natural thing for quite a lot of people to do.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But as you know, as we kind of conclude here, is there any, aside from just telling people to, you know, check out the book and everything like that, are there any kind of final thoughts you want to leave us on or anything like that? For our listeners here?
Yeah, well, it's a bit cheap because like the final thought is sort of related to the like invocation to check out the book, is that I've done my best to try to summarize the sort of headline takeaways. But what I believed that I was working on over the last 4 years was primarily a work of history. And I've been gratified to see different people come away with it with different conclusions. Like people, it is like quite, hopefully it's like a story that is rich enough in detail that the process of reading it is going to be probably lead you to a different set of ideas about what happened than what I just described right now. So yeah, that is my final takeaway. I always try to make the point that even though I've been like running around and saying this, it's about this and it's about that, that I hope that it works as a work of history that is open to interpretation and reinterpretation.
It does. And I think as well, you know, just asking that question that you asked all the interviewees, you know, what would you tell a teenager in this or that country who may live through a political explosion or might attempt to change life in their country? You know, what lessons would you draw from your own experience and impart to them? You know, in asking that question as part and parcel of building this history as well, you know, that's, I mean, it's a call to action, you know, and I think those two things are necessarily inseparable. So, you know, thank you for putting that out.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that like, you know, if you were to the book doesn't answer the question of like what is to be done, right? Like there is because based on what all the interviewees say and based on the various national contexts of the people that might come to the book, there's a lot of different ways that one could choose to organize based on what you're trying to achieve, political conditions in your own country, your own community. There's a lot of things that could be done, but I think hopefully the book does encourage people to do something and to do something with other human beings and work together with not if not do exactly this, to do something with other people with that want to build a better world in the ways that you do.
Absolutely, 100%. Well, we're working, everybody's working to try and figure out what is to be done. Vincent, if you end up
Yeah.
writing What Is to Be Done Part Two,
Part
come back on
two.
the show to tell us.
Okay.
We're eager to hear. Where can people find more of you, websites wise and social media?
Yeah, the book, I mean, if you just go to the www.ifweburn.com, that is a page on my personal website that is will have the links to buy the book and things, but also from that there you can easily find my actual website, which is just vincentbevins.com, or my Twitter, which is VINNCENT. But ifweburn.com will get you anywhere you need, based on this conversation.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you to everyone for listening. The tagline of our show is to read good books and organize. And this has been an episode about reading good books and the necessity of organization. So appreciate you all. You have a good one.
Been a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.